You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 14 January, Japanese bank lending came in earlier this morning, up 3.1% from 2.9% previously. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Kian Nyana from Scope Prime Life Healthcare, selling another business, about 14 billion foot. And I want to touch on oil with him. Oil is running, and that could be a worry. Archie Hart from 91, opportunity. He's an emerging market. We'll touch on Trump 2.0 in China as well. Wandile Shalobo from Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. What's driving the rise in cocoa prices and coffee? Can we expect any respite? This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Compulsory VAT registration threshold last increased in 2009. The 1 million threshold should have doubled by now. Business Day, Competition Commission calls for overhaul of fresh produce sector. Report reveals barriers to competition, including poor infrastructure and regulatory obstacles. Morning markets, the US was mixed. S&P up 0.2%, NASDAQ down 0.3%. Over in the East, mixed. Sydney is down 0.2%, Tokyo is open again and down 1.8%, Hong Kong up 1.4%, Tencent 2% higher. Commodities, red. Gold, 2,686. Brent, 80.72. Platinum, 9.72. Palladium, 9.53. The Rand is 18.97. Bitcoin, 95,000. Top 40 opening call. Green open, 430 points or around 0.6% higher.
MoneyWeb Now. On the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Kian Nyana from Scope Prime Care. Appreciate the early morning. So last year, Life Healthcare sold their Alliance Medical Group. Out the blocks this year, they're talking to potentially sell their Life Molecular Imaging business, about 14 billion rand value. Their market cap's only around 23, 24 billion. I suppose in some senses, good for shareholders because we get some nice special dividends. What do you make of the deal? What do you make of Life Healthcare post selling off their LMI business?
You know, Simon, businesses are only sold in two scenarios, where management does not believe that they are fairly valued by shareholders, or two, they're in distress and they need cash injections at that time. And looking at the financial position of Life Healthcare at the moment, they don't need the cash. They've just distributed almost 10.6 billion in the previous financial year. So the question you have to ask yourself is, is management of the view that shareholders could not value this LMI business correctly and they thought that the quickest value unlock was to sell it, or did they not see good prospects for the business? And I think it's the latter. For a very long time, I just believed that investors were valuing this business at zero. Mm-hmm. And for them to buy it at 1.3 billion and now sell it for potentially almost 14 billion, that's 14 times what they actually paid for that business, which is a good deal.
I take your point. Absolutely. And as you're saying that, I mean, there's a bunch of companies, I think to myself, hang on, they potentially have hidden assets that the market just doesn't give value to. And I like your idea. Then basically, you have to sell it because you can't convince the market. Let's switch completely. Let's talk Brent. You and I have talked energy over the years. It was kind of floating for some time around the sort of 70 level mark. And then suddenly, this year, late last year and now into this year, started running, trading above 80. Should we be worried about the oil price?
I think we should. I think it's these sanctions which President Biden has imposed on Russia, and this goes to the producers of oil, the tankers which deliver this oil. And essentially, it is to bolster Ukraine's position in the brokered deal that Trump envisages in the future. So it's preparing for the Trump presidency right now. And for me, what we're seeing on the demand side is that there's a colder Northern Hemisphere winter alongside a Chinese Lunar New Year, which is expected to drive up demand, while right now OPEC is cutting supply. So that really presents quite the dichotomy of a situation where the supply side is coming down while demand is rising. And that's why you've seen Brent crude oil touch $80 a barrel.
Could it get to, 80 is a giant move from the 70, which it was sort of around Christmas time and late last year. Is more upside possible here? Europe's still in their winter, a lot of the geopolitical's not going away. We could see, is 90, dare we say even 100?
I think it is quite rightly possible in the short term, and I think primarily because primarily because of the fact that we don't know what the Indian and Chinese economy are going to do. We already know the US is very strong right now. So now if there's a surprise in good economic and GDP in India and China as the second and third largest consumers of oil, that could throw a spanner amongst the works with supply coming down. So I do think I've seen a consensus estimate from analysts which predict about $85 a barrel. But I still think it could push 90 if those two elements come out on the wrong side.
I like that. We'll watch GDP growth. China, India, that will give us a good understanding. We'll leave it there. Kenya Nyama, Scope Prime, appreciate the early morning time. And that is our poll today. LinkedIn and Twitter is around that Life Molecular Imaging business. Do you think it's a good deal for Life Healthcare? I liked what Kia said there, which is that, you know what? Sometimes a business just isn't getting valued, in which case you need to sell it because bang, then suddenly it's $14 billion. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Archie Hartcote, Portfolio Managing Emerging Market Equities at 91. Archie, appreciate the time. I want to touch emerging markets, but first let's quickly start with President-elect Trump, who will be sworn in on Monday. I think what a lot of people perhaps miss about this is Trump version 2, but a lot of his trade policies from his first term, particularly those around China, were largely left in place by Biden.
That's completely right, Simon. So if you look at the policies that Trump put in place in 2017, essentially higher tariffs, more protectionism, a more competitive, aggressive stance with China, that whole American first thing. The interesting thing about Biden is he didn't really change it. If anything, tariffs went up, there were more restrictions on tech sales into China, etc. So really, the broad sort of spectrum of where we are, the direction was fixed 8 years ago. So really, I think the direction of travel is not really in debate. It's really whether we see a significant acceleration in the direction of travel.
And we've also seen less China resilience than the US. In the note you and your colleague put out, exports down from 25% to 14% in the last decade. So perhaps just broadly also, maybe a little less impact, although still going to make a lot of headlines.
I think Trump 2.0 will be a little bit different from Trump 1.0 simply because the world's changed in 8 years. And as you say, China's exposure to direct exports to the US is now only down to 13% of their total exports. So 87% of their exports now go elsewhere. So there's been a lot of diversification of China's exports, and that continues. So part of the reason I think China and India signed a border treaty is because they both want to ramp up trade. And Xi Jinping was recently in Brazil, again, I think, partly to ramp up trade. So clearly, more restrictive trade policies from the US are negative, but I don't think we should overstate that impact, given the change we've already seen over the past 8 years.
And changes in China. Still great GDP growth for the size of the economy, but lower GDP growth, an aging population, people buying less luxury, perhaps in part due to the property crisis. There is changes happening in China beyond just their sort of trade partners, internal changes.
Yeah, I'd say we're quite cautious on the direction of the Chinese economy. We think deflation's there to stay. There's no magic bullet to turn around the property market. I think growth will struggle to get beyond sort of low mid-single digit. But having said that, the market itself is much more interesting. The market's going at a big discount. I think it's interesting for all the excitement about India in 2024. the Chinese market was up 20% in US dollars and India was up less than 12. So sometimes it's the tortoise that wins the race and not the Indian hare, if you like. And I think certainly whilst we're not particularly excited by the market, we see lots of things to do on a bottom-up basis. So, for example, Chinese consumers feeling squeezed down, feeling unhappy with life, feeling cautious, and that there's a significant trading down. So you don't want to own the luxury good stocks or the premium stocks, but stocks which benefit from that trade down. So, for example, we own China's major food delivery company. So people, rather than going out and eating in nice restaurants, simply getting takeaway. Business is pretty good. We've got an aging population which needs more healthcare, more pensions, more life insurance. There's opportunities there. And I think the final thing to say is that I think Chinese corporates are not unaware that the environment's pretty tough. So they're cutting costs, they're refocusing, they're rationalizing their businesses. And actually, a lot of them are increasing dividends and buying back stock. So whilst the macro in China is quite tough, we see some opportunities on the bottom upside, certainly.
You mentioned India there, the Chinese equity market doing better than India. There must be opportunities in India. I mean, it is a giant economy. It is set to overtake China as the world's largest emerging market economy in the next couple of years. Is there space for some sort of bottom-up approach in India as well?
Yeah, very much. I mean, we very much like the Indian story. I think one of the sort of, I suppose, really unknown facts about India is one of the things that's driving the economy is they've had this policy of giving everyone in India an ID card. Mm-hmm. Think about getting an ID. With an ID, you can then buy a phone, you can get a bank account, the government knows who you are, so they can give you support payments, etc. Without an ID, you really don't participate. You're really, really a nobody. 500 million people in India have been given ID cards over the last 10 years, which is quite a dramatic increase in the economically active people. And if you're looking for one of the reasons why growth's come through, you add 500 million people to any economy, it's pretty big. So we think the opportunities in India are pretty sort of huge. The trouble is, of course, is that's a consensus view and the market's priced that. So valuations are very high. So we think there are longer term opportunities, but I think the valuations make us a little bit cautious and quite selective in the short term.
What about other emerging markets? If we're seeing the likes of China starting to chat with India, with Brazil, as you mentioned, opportunities in other EMs out there?
So we really like the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East is really transforming. They know the age of oil is coming to an end in the next few decades, and they're investing to diversify their economies. If you look at the UAE, the UAE is a very unusual place. It's open for immigration. It's open for trade. It's got 15% corporate tax and 0% personal tax. It's an incredibly attractive place to do business. When I mentioned Saudi Arabia, there's a sharp intake of breath generally from people when I mention it. Mm-hmm. But the female participation in the labor force has doubled in the last 5 years. There's a social transformation there, which I think is largely not seen. And if you look at Southeast Asia, a lot of the markets there are benefiting from manufacturing moving out of China into places like Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia. So there's a lot of growth there. So really, we think there's some quite exciting things to do. And there are beneficiaries of today's world. It's not just losers from Trump 2.0. And we're obviously very focused on finding those winners.
Yeah, losers are going to be winners lurking somewhere. We'll leave it there. It's Archie Hart, Co-Portfolio Manager, Emerging Market Equities at 91. Appreciate the time. Give your money the return it wants without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Wandile Shilobo, Chief Economist at Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. Wandile, appreciate the time in this new year. Two of my simpler pleasures in life, coffee and chocolate. And I watch the prices of them as I'm buying them. Also, the underlying commodity prices. We've seen cocoa, which, I mean, $3,000 a metric ton used to be a lot for cocoa. It's now around $11,000. You got any sense of what's happening in cocoa prices?
I think what we're seeing, Simon, happening across really the cocoa, coffee beans, and I would even throw in the orange juice, is the issue of the weather conditions that have been super unfavorable in terms of cocoa, much of Africa. And when you think about coffee, South America, Vietnam, and the same for orange juice, it has been the droughts followed by the heavy rainfall. All of these have really disrupted the production conditions. But what worries more, Simon, now is that even when we think about the outlook for this year or next year, there's a lot of replanting of trees that needs to happen in cocoa. The same is true with the other commodities on citrus as well as coffee beans. And I think all of this is causing what we have already seen as elevated prices to be something of almost a new normal, or at least over a few next years will be sitting at these levels that we're seeing.
Am I right, sort of, that you plant a tree, but you're not going to get a crop in year one? It'll take, I don't know, 2, 3, maybe 5 years before you get a crop from that tree as it matures.
That's absolutely the case. And it's a case indeed in all of the fruits, which is why it's so difficult whenever you are replacing the trees. And I think the other downside of climate change that we don't talk a lot about is that these extreme weather conditions not only disrupt the harvest in that particular year, but they also disrupt just the nature and the quality of these trees to an extent that you end up with a lot of diseases and having to replant. And all of this really then weighs on the supplies, which is what we are seeing now as a consequence of it.
And certainly coffee is regional. You can't just go grow coffee anywhere. You couldn't, for example, start a coffee plantation in the UK. That makes challenges. Is that the same for cocoa, where you can't just say, well, this is no longer a great region, let's try somewhere else? There are geographic limitations.
There are absolutely geographic limitations, which is why the African continent continues to play such a significant role in cocoa. I have recently seen now that some of the major chocolate makers are already even investing on saying, is there any of the products that we can actually artificially do like they do with the sweeteners and whatnot that can be a replacement for this? That is yet to be seen, but I think people will still be looking to get products with cocoa ultimately at some point. And I think all of these innovation and the thinking is as a result of these climate change disruption. But you are right, these things are regional. You cannot just grow them anywhere.
Yeah, and they must be careful with messing with my chocolate recipe. Is this also, I mean, my sense, and maybe I'm wrong here, is that it is mostly small growers in coffee and cocoa. These aren't giant multinationals. It's often someone with maybe an acre or two growing and then selling up the value chain.
That's absolutely the case, which is why for me, I always get worried when I hear people saying they are looking for other substitutes, because some of the news we are hearing from West Africa is that there are growers that have actually gone out of their way to borrow money to till new land in anticipation that these higher prices that we are seeing will be there for some time, and they are watching the supply constraints. So if one can introduce anything then that disrupts that trend and those expectations, of course, it would have a major downside economic impact on those growers, because these are small family farms really in much of the African continent that are producing this. And of course, then working with their governments, their aggregators, so that they put all of this together, it's nicely graded and ending up in various export markets that we all buy finished products from.
And is this almost, I mean, I'm thinking, and no doubt this is too simplistic, but I'm thinking of sort of smaller scale subsistence farming in South Africa, which is often very low on technology. It's high on labor. And I'm imagining a lot of this is probably the same in coffee and cocoa, and hugely important in terms of labor, but in terms of income for families and households.
Hugely important. And you will remember that in much of these countries in West Africa, there isn't a lot of economic opportunities. Yeah. You see mining and you see agriculture. So it's hugely important in providing work and just the economic lifeline on this. And you are right, somewhat similar to what we see in South Africa. Although then in South African case, you would find that a lot of smallholder farmers are largely on the grain related products, which are a staple. But I would say the other country that takes a similar approach to that is if you think about the avocado growers in Kenya, where it's a range of small growers, same with their tea, but then working with the aggregators that put all of these products together, nicely grade them, and make sure that they are ready for export market. And I think those aggregators play an enormous role in creating the market linkages for those smallholder farmers.
We'll leave it there, Wandile Shalobo, with perhaps not the best news for our coffee and chocolate fans. You're, of course, Chief Economist, Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. Wandile, always appreciate the insights. That's it for today. We're chatting with Comrade Mapuani yesterday, talking that U.S. jobs data number from Friday. Very strong. And we asked her about the potential impact on rate cuts. And we asked you if this changes the Fed decision and expectations for 2025. Half of you said yes, but we'll still get two cuts. A third of you said, yep, the cuts are now over. And the rest were saying, nope, inflation's over. We can have a lot more cuts. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobukle, Siren, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.